you know, we're very much about empowering individuals to make changes in their everyday life, and the belief that at scale, that leads to something substantial and transformational for society.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of Design Meets Insight. This is an idea that we've had at Hetero Architects for quite a while, which was to do a podcast, which was to record and share some of the kind of fascinating conversations we have with people that seems to be on an almost weekly basis in the wider profession. At Hetero, we're quite an outward-looking architecture practice, and we work with some really, really interesting people, which led us to the idea of creating a podcast that discusses some of the kind of broader topics that we as an industry are facing. Just to quickly introduce myself, my name is Ben Stewart. I'm your host. I'm also an architect and associate at Hetero Architects. And on the first episode of Design Meets Insight today, I'm joined by Nikki Whiteman from Savills. And she's been kind enough to co-host a kind of mini-series with us. I guess as a bit of backstory, I first met Nikki in March last year at a UNI event all about esports. Since then, Nikki and I have had some fascinating chats, and I really like the idea of us collaborating together. So we've come up with a suggestion of recording a mini-series that Nikki will curate. So Nikki, why don't you introduce yourself?
So Ben, hello. I'm really excited to be on the podcast. And I hope it's going to be a lot of fun. I guess what I'm interested in talking about is always going to be talking about the future. My role is really predicated around talking about how we will live, work, learn, play in the future. But I guess, and certainly over the last year since we got to know each other, the future has been really unpredictable. So for me, this series, what I would really want this series to be, and what I'm really hopeful that it will do, is to talk about the future in a way that is positive and hopeful. I guess it is definitely going to be different. We kind of know that. But I want to talk about things that are coming, how we'll live, work, learn, play, what any of that means to our cities, our towns, our buildings, our homes, and to really think about something that is positive.
So I guess it's a good time to introduce our first guest, which is Sasha Celestial One, who is the co-founder and CEO of Olio. I'm sure you may have heard about this, but they are an app that provides a community-driven solution to the problem of food waste. It's a really, really interesting app. So Olio has almost 3 million users, supported by 60,000 volunteers promoting Olio in local communities. So, I mean, the scale at which they're reaching is fascinating. So as Nikki just touched on this idea of hopefulness, collectively, Olio users have successfully shared 12 million portions of food, which is just a fantastic scale to get your head around. So the app, as I said, the app's gone from strength to strength. And as you'll hear in the podcast, what's really interesting from kind of an architectural perspective is that this is touching on the topic of circular economy. That is something that we at Hetero are kind of working really closely with a number of developers about. And I think it's really interesting that Sasha's app Olio is looking at the circular economy from a kind of a very micro scale. And we as the construction industry are looking at this at a very kind of industrial level, at a very macro scale. So there's a really interesting cycle there. But Nikki, why don't you tell us a bit more how you got to know Sasha?
So I've known Sasha for a little while, and she is one of these people that always makes me sort of wonder what I'm doing with my life, because she seems to be out there kind of just genuinely changing the world. Ben, we've talked about this a lot. The environment is at the heart of pretty much all the conversations we have. We know how important this is to our organizations and to the people that we work with. So I think, you know, the environment is going to be a theme throughout this entire series, I guess, always on some level. But I really wanted to begin by talking to Sasha. The issue of food waste, I guess I was not aware of just the scale of the problem that we face, but also I guess in terms of the hopefulness piece, the opportunity to actually individually and organizationally do something about that. And that's what Sasha is going to talk about.
Perfect. Well, okay, let's get into the episode, which was recorded at the end of last year over Zoom between Sasha, Nikki and I. And let us know what you think and get in contact with us if you want to know any more at heteroarchitects.com, or find Nikki or I and Sasha on LinkedIn. And the Olio website is olioex.com. I hope you enjoyed the episode.
Well, first of all, it's just nice to talk to you. And connect with people who I don't necessarily work or live with, which is what I've been doing a lot of lately. So Olio is, Olio, for those that don't know it, is a sharing platform, a free sharing platform. It connects neighbors with each other directly to share anything of value that might otherwise go to waste, so that it, that value can be captured and utilized and not wasted. But specifically, we are focused on unlocking the value of food that is wasted in the home and local community. And the reason we're doing that is because, you know, if food, food waste were a country, it would be the third largest contributor to the climate change, after the USA and China. So it's a massive, massive strain on the environment. The fact that a third of all food produced globally goes to waste, and most of that food waste takes place in our homes. So very simply, if someone has food they're not going to eat or they don't want for whatever reason, and there's a lot of it out there, food, unwanted food, they take a picture, add a description, click submit on the app, and then it is listed within the app and it's a notification to people nearby to say, hey, you know, Sasha's giving away half a birthday cake or whatever the situation is. And someone says, oh, actually, I'll take, you know, I fancy some cake. They click request and then they pop around and they pick that food up. And that's happening tens, if not sometimes hundreds of thousands of times a day in the UK and also in a few other markets as well.
Is that something that I'm just thinking from a Britishness? There's a kind of like, there's a politeness to everyone. Is that, is, you've seen that ramp up, more and more people are taking advantage. I think once you've done it once, you're like, oh, this is great.
Well, it's certainly true that the biggest hurdle is getting people to list, to share for the first time. So from day one, nearly 5 years ago, demand has just been incredibly strong. So 3 out of 4 listings, and now more than 4 out of 5 listings, are not only requested, but half of all listings are requested and picked up in under 30 minutes. So there's really strong demand out there from people who want, or in many cases need, that food. It goes a long way to maybe supplementing a scarce food budget, or people, I think, are hardwired in many ways to love free food. We all love free food. But that, coming back to the point about the British sort of sense of reserve, it is a bit of an unusual thing to think, all right, I've got half a birthday cake. The sides that are cut are probably a bit stale. It might not still be looking its best, but it's still delicious and made from quality ingredients. You know, I'm going to offer this up to a stranger. Like, that is, takes a little bit of a leap of faith. But the reward from doing so, and the magic of having 1, 2, or 3 people instantly say, oh my God, that looks delicious, I haven't had homemade cake in years or something, I can be there in an hour, that's just really satisfying. So it, once people list for the first time, they continue to do so.
I guess as well, there must be something really good in terms, just particularly at the moment, that just that sense of being able to connect with people on some level.
Yeah, I think it's more important than ever, really. Obviously, food is something that all humans have to think about several times a day. And so it's a really sort of a leveler. And I think that due to the pandemic, people have been acutely aware they might have neighbors sort of in need, and are also people are at home more and having to sort of confront their own waste. A lot of times, I think waste is a little bit out of sight, out of mind. And so it's just really accentuated the importance of, I don't know, doing the right thing, being generous, and that urge to help someone. Olio provides that sense of immediate gratification. Oh, I can help someone right away. It makes me feel useful and like I'm doing my bit.
And are you seeing a take up in cities or villages, or where's the kind of the focal points for this app? And is the demographic quite spread? I'd imagine older people would be really interested as well as younger people, I think.
It obviously works best where the network is the densest. And you start to, you know, by definition, sort of the more people you have closer to you, more likely it is there's something you want for the distance you would need to go to travel, because people are doing that internal calculation sort of all the time. How far would I go to collect, or et cetera. So it does, as more people join, it works better, but we see it working all over the place. It's just that the density versus the user profile are sort of there's a direct correlation. So the lower the density, the more your users are going to be who you might think of as really early adopters. They're already really involved in the environment or community and really passionate and are taking sort of big steps in their life to live a more sustainable lifestyle. As you get a more dense network, you start to bring along more mainstream people who might not be motivated by the environment at all, but actually quite fancy a free spare bottle of champagne that someone doesn't want anymore because they're teetotaling this week or something. So there's a lot of dynamics at play. It is fairly universal from an age, demographic, you know, sort of every which way. We pretty much are representative of the society, of the population at large, which is fantastic because we need everyone to participate in this problem if we have a chance of solving it.
So I guess we're talking about the idea of individuals at home engaging with this, the idea of food waste. Such, where are businesses with this? You know, what's your experience of that, and what, how are you working with businesses to try and solve some of the problem?
That's a great question. So if you look at the sort of the supply chain from farm to fork, there's obviously waste that takes place all along that. And there are different interventions, whether they're government, business, nonprofit, at each sort of different stage in the supply chain. On the farm level, you know, we're not really getting involved. There's loads of food that is just left on the farm and never harvested because it doesn't meet the criteria for the supermarkets. You might have quite strict conditions for buying, or there's large cancellations at the last minute because there's fluctuations in weather and demand. But we don't really participate in that part of the supply chain. But then from anything that has to do with food retail, we do have a program, which is how we've monetized as a business, which is called our Food Waste Heroes program. And that's where we recruit volunteers and train them on food safety. And then we match those volunteers with businesses that have surplus food that they can't sell and can't be donated to charity for whatever reason. And those volunteers collect that food, take it straight home, add it to the app, and then they serve as a distribution point for their neighbors for that food that would have otherwise gone to waste. We've got 11,000 food waste heroes now, and we are working with loads of big companies that your listeners are, I'm sure, familiar with, from Pret a Manger to Costa, and we're just in the middle of our national rollout with Tesco, which is fantastic. That's ultimately going to be more than 5,000 volunteers collecting weekly across all of their stores. We're going to continue to grow that part of the organization. But for us, it really is a strategic way to unlock the food that's wasted in the home. Because here in the UK, post-farm gate, 71% of food waste takes place in the home. And that's really ultimately what we're trying to tackle.
Can you give us a sense of scale? Like how many users daily use Olio? And because it sounds like some of the Tesco's, for example, I mean, it sounds like actually the scale of Olio is massive.
It's quite big. So I guess there's 1 million items listed to, on Olio every month, shared between neighbors. I don't know off the top of my head, but that's several hundred thousand neighbor to neighbor encounters where value food is being given away for free. And we've got at about 300,000 active users, and quite a few million more who we're currently trying to always get back onto the platform and get active. We obviously have people who joined, you know, several years ago when we were much smaller and not a lot was going on. So we're, you know, busy re-engaging them now that we've gotten a lot bigger and there's a lot more activity. It feels big on the one hand, but it's minuscule in comparison to where we need to get to. We have a stated ambition of trying to get to 1 billion users by the end of the decade. And that's really not out of, of course, that would be lovely. And my parents would be proud, but really it's because the planet needs us to. We've got to stop we've got to divert all of that waste, right? That 1 billion users can, if you think about how much waste 1 billion users could prevent from going to landfill and instead could bring back into the economy at the local level, and we could extract the full value from those resources, food and otherwise, that could have a really transformational impact in terms of mitigating the effects of the climate crisis.
So Sasha, tell us a little bit about your journey into the space, kind of your background and how you got here, why it was this problem, I guess, you wanted to solve.
It was a So it was a circular journey, which is fitting. So I am from rural America. I was raised by hardcore hippies who I had a very untraditional childhood. I'm the oldest of six children, and I also grew up in, you know, I used to think that I was poor when I was a kid. That's how I thought. I'm a poor kid. I mean, looking back on it, I can see why I thought that, because my mom spent a lot of her time trying to make ends meet. And part of that involved collecting things that other people threw away. So I would follow her around town and we would pick up anything that was being thrown away that still had value. So if houses were being torn down, we would take toilet fixtures and wooden banisters and, you know, anything that could be sort of salvaged. And we'd take it home and resell it or fix it up, et cetera. And I really sort of thought this was horrifying as a child and very embarrassing, but it instilled in me at a very young age a deep aversion to waste and a sense, you know, that we have a duty to, I guess, you know, maximize the value of the resources that we have. And my personal form of rebellion, as I often say, was to sort of run away to New York and become an investment banker and then a management consultant. I was really looking for financial security and professional security. And, you know, my childhood, whilst absolutely lovely, didn't have those elements in it. And that's something that I didn't want to replicate in my life. So I spent 13 or 14 years, you know, in the corporate world. But what happened was when I became a mother and I was on maternity leave, I had a very sort of cliched moment of reflection where I thought that, I love working, but at the time I was working for American Express, which is a fantastic company, but sort of selling credit cards to international banks was not necessarily my idea of my life's purpose. And so I did some thinking, and along with my co-founder, Tessa, who had a very different but similar upbringing in terms of values, we decided to put our commercial skills and experience to good use to solve a major problem for the planet. And when we realized just how much food was going to waste, it was sort of that aha, instantaneous, this is a problem that we can solve. And we decided to launch Olio. And that was back in 2015. And we've grown from just Tess and I to now just under 40 people. And we've got active communities in Mexico, New Zealand, Singapore, and a few other places outside the UK. So it's been quite the journey.
So from the launch in 2015, I guess my impression is that this space, this circular space, has really grown. You know, mm-hmm. just the terminology, the nature of the kind of circular economy is something we're all becoming increasingly more familiar with. How are mm-hmm. you seeing the broader companies and businesses around you and the community that's growing? And presumably that's an incredible and positive thing happening right now.
So specifically within the food space, there are seen dozens of organizations and businesses enter the space to try to take waste streams and turn them into something that can be commercialized so that to build a sustainable business model around basically, preventing waste or reusing waste, whether it's whether it's food that would have otherwise gone to waste being boxed up into ugly veggies or turned into snack products, or beer that's being brewed from day-old bread. There's been lots and lots of interesting, loads of marketplaces have come about trying to match different players along the supply chain with short-dated stock, right, to be able to sell short-dated stock. It has really felt like it's been thriving. That said, there's probably some element of confirmation bias that I'm exhibiting, because I'm, of course, going to note all of that activity. But I think the facts, I don't have them off the top of my head, but there's some, an insane amount of money has flooded into food tech, which, of course, is going to sort of lab-grown meats and all of that type of those types of innovations, but also to the prevention of food waste, which I think is widely recognized as one of the biggest problems that mankind can solve in order to, reduce carbon emissions.
It's a really interesting thought that, as you've explained, Olio, it sounds like it has such a high community value. I was thinking of other things that have proliferated, like got really popular during lockdown, but I guess food delivery but there's no community with it. It's a very one-way thing. Whereas actually, every time I think of an example of Olio being used, there's a human interaction and a genuine, like beyond business, a genuine community engagement value. I think that's fascinating that you know, I don't know how that's monetized in any way, but as a community engagement tool, it's fascinating. I think it's really good.
Yeah, I think we've sort of gone on a journey ourselves over the course of this year, because we've been really anchored around the free sharing of food. And we did eventually add non-food as well. So any household products that's, you know, still have value, cosmetics, cleaning products, you know, clothing, anything really that can be given away. We were quite worried that due to safe sharing requirements that actually we might see our activity shrink, but we ended up having 5 times more activity between March and August than we'd had in the last 5 years. So what happened was everyone was at home and everyone felt very conscious of their activity. And they also thought, I've been meaning to get around to trying Olio, and now's a great time to do it. So we just had an explosion of activity. But we also, which meant we brought on lots of more mainstream users, and we were able to say, actually, here's an opportunity to think about, you know, how can we reach even more mainstream people who aren't yet drawn to our proposition of free food and free non-food. And so we did a lot of research this year, and we ended up launching a few new sections in the app, and they're all around the themes of hyperlocal, community, and planet friendly. So in October, we launched a section in the app called Made, which is really born out of seeing how people at home, how many people sort of picked up a side hustle, right? They started baking extra bread for the first time, or they picked up a hobby. And a lot of people also found themselves unemployed or furloughed and were looking to make extra income. So with the Made section enables people to sell homemade food and sustainable handmade crafts. Things are upcycled, things, you know, chutneys and preserves that are made from foraged fruits. You know, as long as it's sustainably made, you're allowed to sell it in the Made section of the app, which has been a really fantastic way to sort of bring in new users and who then come in maybe for the Made section, but then they discover the free section and they start thinking about the waste that they have in their homes and how that could be given away instead of wasted. And we're going to continue to layer on additional sections in the app for different use cases. So sort of the next one that's coming up is a borrow section, where you can lend and borrow for free the sort of higher value, not super high value, but, you know, slightly higher value, but low infrequent use case items. Maybe it's a drill or a pair of tennis rackets you only use once or twice a year. You know, things that you have around your house that are underutilized that could benefit someone nearby. So we don't all need to go out and buy our own drill or our own set of tennis rackets. If we're just, you know, collectively on our street, we've probably got enough for everyone.
Sasha, I'm really interested in the idea when you talked about your family and when you were growing up, and this idea of kind of like a sort of embarrassment about this, you know, we're reusing things, you know, we're not being wasteful. Mm-hmm. But that not sitting that comfortably, is there something you think broadly happening where as a society we are changing our attitude to that? Are we seeing that? I'm just kind of thinking about young people. I'm thinking about, you know, this, you know, shift to vintage clothing, perhaps that whole idea. It suddenly feels, you know, it feels kind of like slightly more fashionable, dare I say, to be able to engage with this. It's not embarrassing to reuse things or recycle them. It actually feels fashionable and relevant. And do you perceive that as being a good thing?
I absolutely do. And I see that as well. I mean, I think I just saw an article in The Sun a few days ago about how secondhand Christmas gifting was all the rage this year. And to me, that really sort of spoke volumes about, you know, mainstream, I guess. I think when I was growing up, having something new by definition made it sort of cooler, right? If it was new. No, you just didn't want things that had already been unboxed or pre-loved. But I do feel that there's a collective sort of shift now, and maybe it was led a little bit with the ban, you know, the sort of fight against disposable plastics, which is a really tangible, low barrier, you know, easy way to get involved in you know, pollution of our natural environment. But I think people started to think about disposable clothing, right? And disposability in a lot of different ways. And actually, of course, fast fashion is still plays a huge important, you know, big role in the economy. But I think people are looking for fabrics that are made from recycled or upcycled other fabrics. There's Depop and Vinted and all of the really, really popular tree-loved clothing sites that all the young people are using. And I think it is now more a badge of honor to say, you know, actually I'm wearing something that's sustainably sourced. And of course, again, confirmation bias. I see this all the time because these are the topics that I follow, but it does feel palpable.
I guess what was really interesting about Olio is that it seems to have kind of made, I know this is the wrong way to say it, made cool this idea of kind of investing in your local community, this idea of like not just localization, like hyper-localization. I might make this for someone who lives three flats up from me.
Yeah.
In terms of like that community, it's so interesting. I think because the reason from a construction industry point of view it's so interesting is because that's also how a lot of clients are starting to think of materials and like, okay, well, hang on, where's that material coming from? And hang on, that makes no sense. But what can we do with local communities? And it's fascinating idea that you're at that very kind of micro scale, and the macro scale is that the construction industry, like an oil tanker, is very slowly, you know, moving. And we're working with some really interesting clients. I hadn't really thought of the scale of your app until you just explained all the different functions it does. It does open up an enormous amount of possibilities.
Thank you.
Sasha, can I ask you, I guess for me, one of the challenges about everything to do with the environment is this feeling that there is this most enormous problem to solve. And as individuals, ultimately, we often end up feeling, I guess, quite powerless. Mm-hmm. Is that, do you think, at the root in terms of technology solutions such as Olio or anything else that we're going to see coming forward? Is that part of how you begin to solve that problem? Is it empowering people, I guess, individually? Is that part of the solution here?
I think it has to be. I don't think we have a choice because, of course, industry and government action is critical, but it takes a longer time. And ultimately, 60% of greenhouse gas emissions are due to the decisions that we as individuals make within our own home and our own consumption. So we don't have a choice. We need individuals to feel empowered to make change. We spent a good 6 months working with doing our own proprietary market research, doing some behavioral studies, and just did a really focus groups, sort of a big piece of work to try and understand what the barrier to, you know, from awareness that there's something, an issue, to action on an environmental sort of issue, right? Like, I know it's bad to waste food. Why am I still doing it? Kind of thing. And what we discovered is you're absolutely right. People do feel overwhelmed. People feel like nothing they do is going to make a difference. People don't understand the good, what they're doing now that is making a difference, why it's important. And it generally, it's a very sort of negative space filled with a lot of sort of bad self-talk where people are sort of chiding themselves for doing things that they know they shouldn't be doing, but don't quite understand why, and they're not convinced it's going to make a difference at scale. So on the back of all of that research, we launched a section in the app called Goals. And the principles are super easy, which I think could be extrapolated for anyone who's trying to get their users, audience, whatever, to make positive changes. So we broke, the Goals is has 150 and more added every week. Really tiny for the most part, actionable steps that people can do almost instantly to lead a greener life. And what we do is we give people credit for the steps that they're already taking, so that they are starting the journey from a position of satisfaction and success. So people are much more likely to introduce new habits if they've accomplished a habit and they're coming at it from with a bit of momentum. There's a fabulous book called Tiny Habits, or you can look at Atomic Habits, and there's loads of books written on habits. And you've got to break things down into tiny little steps, and then it's tiny enough that you can't really almost not accomplish it. And then once you've accomplished it, no matter how small it is, you have this great sense of satisfaction, and you can set yourself a slightly larger goal. So, you know, giving people credit for carrying, you know, not using, for carrying a tote bag with them, for using a keep cup, for all of that kind of stuff. Then, and then introducing slightly more challenging goals, and sequencing it in such a way that everyone's always sort of winning at the game of making these choices, does engage people, I think, along that journey, in a way that has been difficult to date. Obviously, there's a long way to go, but we're seeing an explosion of apps, technologies, interfaces, messaging, blogs, whatever, you know, trying to figure out how to speak with people in a way that it motivates them to make positive, greener decisions.
I think the idea that people are really starting to engage in this process, and I guess you must see this in the app just taking off, is that you apply that to kind of their daily routine and how they consume food or how they waste things. But I guess as well, we're starting to see if people are going on holiday, they want to also feel like they're doing good, and you know, how do I get there? How am I going to fly there? Am I going to go by train? Mm-hmm. We're working on an eco village or eco resort in Tavira, and the whole point is that it's this new type of resort, and actually it's got greenhouses, you know where the food comes from, like all the materials are locally sourced, the actual construction methodology, but the client wants to see every single step mapped out in that same sort of way that your app's doing on that micro scale. And actually it's attracting this kind of, I guess, your type of customer base, which is that the people are really engaging in the idea of like sustainability and environmental kind of issue solving. And I think it's fascinating that it's starting to come across the whole industry. It's really exciting.
That sounds like a place I would like to go visit.
Yeah, it's
one day.
When we can fly. I think your app is kind of guiding people to understand the process a bit more. And I think, if like you said, if you can tangibly see it in your hands, I think it's a very big market all of a sudden, isn't it?
I really love that idea of sort of taking small steps. It's a bit like the running the marathon thing, you know, that just you begin somewhere. I think that feels really powerful and positive. I guess I'm curious as to what degree you guys work with education. If it feels to me, is this about embedding just different habits, different norms, you know, and it feels as though surely we start with younger people, you know, you grow up differently, you think about this differently, maybe.
I have an 8-year-old, and he's certainly, what he's learning at school makes me very proud, you know, that they are learning a lot of things about diversity and inclusion and the environment, all kinds of themes that I didn't learn as a child. So that's fantastic. We do have some lesson plans, and we have some resources for schools, and we've sort of worked with different sort of government agencies who are focused on education intervention. But it's a very slow sort of process, I guess, and we're not leading on that. Tess and I are probably both a bit too impatient. Of course, that's important, but we're not necessarily the best ones to lead on that. But we do support it where we can.
So if you were hopeful about a future, a next year, a really quick, impatient next year future, for you guys, what do you think are some of the most important things that we might see change and happen?
Very, you know, Olio itself is sort of really focused on getting to scale. I'd love to have one or two or three more supermarket partnerships come about. Tesco is by far and away the most advanced in their terms of thinking about this. But I'm hopeful that some of the other larger supermarkets aren't that far behind. And the reason is because we're talking about, I think last week we're only a third of the way through the scale up. And last week we, you know, collected and redistributed 33 tons of food just from Tesco. And more than ever, people need access to that food. You know, we have food insecurity is just at an all-time high, and going to get even higher this winter. And so I'd love for more and more businesses to do the right thing and donate their unsold food. obviously it feeds people, but also it helps bring more people into our platform who are then part of our community, who then start to make positive changes to their lifestyle and give back. So that would be pretty exciting.
It's fascinating, this idea that you've just said, like an app manages to kind of not make it so visible that you're asking for things. And actually it's quite like a really easy way for a digital asset to create a physical community. And it's interesting. I just think it's interesting that what you're doing is kind of being echoed in the industry, because we're working with Grosvenor on a number of their reusable assets. So what can they do with their existing stock? And part of it is also looking at how an app could help the people in the building. So it's not just the building itself, it's the community that exists in the building. I hadn't realized Olio does borrowing and physical goods as well as food as well. So I think, yeah,
I think it's just we're doing it with Grosvenor. I think we're doing a trial with them, or at least it's in discussion. So
interesting.
I wanted to, yeah. Anyway, but yes, it's not just for food. I mean, food is really a sort of our mission, but there's, you know, especially if you think about Christmas, right? And all the, do we all need to buy brand new jigsaw puzzles and brand new toys and brand new, especially for children? Mm. No, we don't. They, you know, kids grow out of things so quickly, and they often don't know if it's new or not and could care less. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of re-gifting and sharing and people being the, you know, Santa's little helper on their street, really.
Yeah, and presumably just in the same way as you talked about that kind of stigma about food and not being able to afford food right now, which is just incredibly difficult for people, Christmas must feel quite stressful. You know, it's a pretty stressful time if you feel as though you have to be able to afford things. So maybe there is something here about this sort of broader shift and this acceptance that, you know, reused, reclaimed things, that movement there, just move, you know, taking the stigma away from that seems to be incredibly culturally important for lots of different reasons.
I agree. I completely agree. I mean, people need, they need role modeling, and it needs to be people that are influential need to role model this behavior and these values. And it does filter down and people take the lead.
Yeah, it's kind of the power of lots of individuals, but just creating this complete wave of a different kind of behavior is what it sounds like.
And I think maybe born out of necessity a little bit right now, due to the pandemic, can actually, you know, accelerate something that was sort of happening anyway.
So I'm curious, because I kind of think as early as a tech startup as well, like how much like app development is there? Because it sounds like you're adding all these different functions all the time. That's like an enormous part. You're a technology company as much.
We are a tech startup. That's absolutely true. If there's, I mean, 10 engineers full-time on the app. And then we have designers and analytics and product managers and customer support. And, you know, to keep an app alive with sort of millions, you know, what do we have? With, you know, millions of user sessions on a weekly basis requires lots of, a lot of things to work. So we do have a quite extensive product team. And then obviously the whole, that's what customer, I mean, no one's a customer quite yet, but that's what the user sees. But then behind the scenes, we have a whole interface that helps us to coordinate collections from businesses, manage the volunteers so that that whole process runs smoothly as well at scale. We are, you know, we do need to have a sustainable business model. You know, we aren't a charity, you know, we have been privately funded to date, and you know, our investors, although they have patient capital and are very, very interested in our social and environmental metrics, they are also looking ultimately for return on their investment. And we're also really excited by the idea of pioneering a profitable company that's also purposeful at scale. And so we have lots of different ideas around how we're going to do that. We are going to trial a freemium version of the app in a couple of months. Free food is always an anchor part of our value proposition that's not going anywhere, and that won't be disrupted. But we'll experiment with putting certain features behind a paywall, or maybe even introducing advertising. Not quite sure yet, but we need to find a way to cover our expenses and fund our growth in a way that will get us to the scale we need to get to be at. in a way that makes commercial sense.
I guess last question from me. I'm kind of curious, you're kind of right in the middle of the tech meets environment space. Hmm. When you're looking around at the community around you, what else have you seen in terms of individuals or businesses or ideas that makes you look at it and think, wow, that's really cool. That's a great idea.
Oh, goodness. That's one of those questions that I probably should have prepared.
I'm so sorry. I didn't.
No, that's okay. I mean, this is an indirect answer, but one of the things I'm excited about is the emergence of sort of new standards and new coalitions of businesses and organizations who are, so for example, we're a founding member of the Positive Movement, and I'm sure you're familiar with B Corp, which is really was a pioneering sort of way for companies to put their mission, their environmental mission or other mission at the heart of their sort of business. Positive takes things sort of to the next level where businesses don't just commit to being sustainable, they have to operate in a way that is actually regenerative. And it's directly addressing the idea of Earth Overshoot Day, which is the day in the year, every year, whereby collectively humanity uses up all of the resources that the Earth can replenish that year. So when they first started tracking this several decades ago, the Earth was in equilibrium. December 31st every year, it was fine. We were regenerating the resources we use. And that date has been slipping backwards or forwards, whatever it is, every year. It was August 3rd this year. And that means everything that's consumed after August 3rd is net depletive, right? So this isn't sustainable. We are going to run out. So what we have to do is to move to regenerative so that we keep pushing that day back out until we're in equilibrium. And there's 100 founding members to this community of businesses, and we're sort of in the middle of turning this into a kite mark and something that any business can sign up to and commit to, and we can take them on that journey. And there's some like incredibly talented people from all around the world who have sort of galvanized to pull this together, and I'm sort of tagging along. But that makes me excited, because then that makes me think, actually, if we can start to get thousands of organizations to sign up to positive, net positive, regenerative activities, we can collectively start to move towards something that's more in equilibrium. And there's everything in there, from agritech to battery to, you know, just every type of green technology you can possibly think of. And I'm blanking on anything that's specifically standing out, but that concept as a whole makes me really excited.
So that feels like super exciting. And actually, a genuine takeaway. This is like something you can, and we've talked a lot about individually what you could do. This sounds like it's definitely something that a business could get on and do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think it sets
it's not just enough to be sustainable. We have to actually be regenerative.
Yes. I was going to say it sets some really like challenging goals for businesses over the next 10 years. I think to say you're going to be carbon neutral in 2030, 10 years is not that far away, you know? So like all these big companies are slowly, you can't pay lip service to anymore. It has to be ingrained in your business DNA now. And I think a lot of some of the older companies are really struggling to kind of shift their focus. Yeah. And I think I guess Olio is kind of that part of that new breed, which is saying, well, we're actually doing genuine good, but we also need to be a business that, you know, creates profit. But ultimately, you've gone backward, you've made benefit, and then now you're trying to build your business in a kind of sustainable way around it. Well, I think that's been absolutely brilliant. I've really enjoyed
good.
That. And
well, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I can hear a little
There you go. Thank you so much to Sasha for being involved, and thanks for Nikki for helping us set this whole thing up and co-hosting with me. We really hope you enjoyed that. Nikki and I have quite a few more interesting guests lined up, which we're really excited for you to hear. So as I said, please let us know any comments or get in touch with us or contact us at, you can contact me at www.heterarchitects.com or follow us on Instagram at heta_architects or find Nikki or I or Sasha on LinkedIn, and the Olio website is olioex.com. Thanks so much for listening. Bye.